It's a joy to be with you tonight and to address the topic that is before us as we think about the real state of the Union, the American presidency, and the King of Kings. We are thinking about how to be faithful Christians as citizens of this earthly kingdom in challenging times in our culture. You are living through the most rapid and pervasive worldview mega shift in the history of the world. Just over a year ago, the Supreme Court of the United States in the Obergefell decision normalized a change in the practice of marriage that had been universally understood in all countries of human culture until the year 2000. Do you understand that until the year 2000, no country in the history of the world had recognized same-sex marriages? Today, to question that is to invite immediate cultural marginalization. 16 years. For the whole of human history up until 2000, everyone thought the same thing about the union between a man and a woman as marriage. 16 years later, to state what everyone else has always believed is to invite immediate, decisive cultural marginalization. That is just a picture of the change that we've gone through. It's one reason why so many people feel as if the culture is entirely antagonistic against them. It's why some people feel like the culture is in decline. And so Christians are asking, how do I respond to that? How do I speak into that? What are my obligations? How are we to go about this? And if I were to preach a sermon, and I'd rather be preaching a sermon right now, where I would start would be the Sermon on the Mount. Sinclair Ferguson wrote a little commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, which was originally titled Kingdom Life in a Fallen World. It's now in print and with the much more unimaginative title of the Sermon on the Mount. I would recommend that little book to you. I think it's now subtitled Kingdom Life in a Fallen World. And I'd recommend it to you to think about as Jesus' marching orders to his disciples in very difficult cultural times. So, for instance, if I were to preach a sermon from the Sermon on the Mount on how we're to respond to our cultural moment, I'd start with the Beatitudes, exactly where Jesus starts, because he starts talking first what? Not about what you're supposed to do, but who you are supposed to be. He describes the character of a believer. What kind of person is able to be salt and light in this world? Someone who is poor in spirit. Someone who is meek. Just go through the Beatitudes and watch him describe the characteristic of the kind of disciple that's able to engage with the culture. And then we'll see this later on tonight when he speaks about being salt and light. What is he doing? But explaining to us how we are to relate to a culture that is turned against us. So if I were to preach a sermon, that's where I would go. In fact, almost all of Jesus' discipleship is directly applicable to this issue. I think you should bear that in mind. He knew that his disciples were going to live through a decisive cultural change. The Israel of his childhood was no longer going to exist after AD 70. And many of his disciples were going to live in that world, and it was going to have massive ramifications for their life and ministry. And he spent his whole time with them preparing them for that moment. And so his words are uniquely applicable to us. But what I'd like to do tonight is look at six things by way of encouraging you in how to respond to this particular cultural moment in which we find ourselves. And the first thing I would like to say is this. When things look bad, know this, God is up to something. When things look bad, God is up to something. When, you know, my father-in-law went home to be with the Lord over a year ago, and he was from the greatest generation. He grew up in a tiny little town, Ridgeway, South Carolina, and his father abandoned the family when he was a little boy, and so he was reared by his grandmother and grandfather. And he started working, sweeping the floors of the R.L. Bryan Company as a 14-year-old boy, and worked his way up to CEO and president of the R.L. Bryan Company. He graduated from high school, but never from college. He enlisted in the U.S. Army during the Second World War and became a captain in the Signal Corps in the Third Army. Marched all the way to Berlin. He was in three D-Days, North Africa, Italy, and southern France. And during the last 10 years of his life, whenever I visited him and he would be watching the news, he would say something to me like this: I didn't fight Hitler so that this country would be the way it is today. He was not encouraged about how things were. And a lot of people, I heard some groans when I said that. A lot of people feel that way. But here's, Christian, remember this: when things look bad, God is up to something. Don't let yourself be discouraged. God is up to something. Let me give you some examples. In the 14th century, Western Christianity in Europe faced three colossal disasters and challenges. In the middle of the 14th century, the Black Death invaded Europe. Somewhere between a third and a half of the population of Europe died as successive waves of the plague would visit city after city. Can you imagine the psychological effect of that level of mortality? I'll never, ever forget September 11th, 2001. I'll never forget it. It was shocking. It imprinted itself on my mind. Can you imagine what it would be like to lose a third of the population? I can't even begin to fathom that. Even in the American Civil War, we lost more Americans than in any other war we've ever fought, we didn't lose anything like a third of the population. People thought the end of the world was coming. It impressed the psychology of Europe for a century. At the same time, the Hundred Years' War began between France and England. And it ravaged, especially France, over and over and over. When invading English armies weren't occupying the country, brigands, vagabond mercenaries were committing rape and pillage and plunder over and over and over on the beleaguered country. People thought the end of the world was coming. At the same time, there was a split in the church. During the 14th century, the Babylonian captivity of the papacy began, and the Pope removed his court to Avignon in France, and for a period of time over the next 100 years, there were sometimes two popes competing for power, sometimes four. And it caused a tremendous loss of confidence in the church. People thought the end of the world was coming. Now, if you and I had lived in Europe during that time frame, it would have been perfectly understandable if we were a little bit discouraged. But it is out of that situation that God prepared and brought about the Protestant Reformation. You can trace direct lines from the events of the 14th and early 15th century into the 16th century Protestant Reformation. God was up to something big. Was it bad? Yes, it was bad. Would it have been very difficult to live through? Yes, it would. Was God up to something? Absolutely, He was. When things are bad, remember, God is up to something. Let me give you another example that I think, a lot of people have asked me, is there anything like what we're experiencing in the United States that you can parallel in our history? Now, here's the situation. Many of you lived through this and you remember this. In the 1960s and 70s and 80s, there was an increasing, a burgeoning, a public influence of evangelical Christianity in our culture. That Christianity had cultural influence in the media and even in government. And then suddenly, by the late 1990s and into the 2000s, there began to be a rapid wane of influence. It was as if evangelicalism reached a peak of cultural influence and then there was a cliff behind it. So that today, many evangelicals feel very culturally marginal, unable to exercise influence. Is there anything like that in our history? Well, as a matter of fact, there is. In the 1640s in England, evangelical Christians in the Church of England, we call them today Puritans, were in charge of the church, the schools and the universities, and the government. There was a Puritan who was the Lord Protector of England. His name was Oliver Cromwell. John Pym and the Long Parliament, Puritans, were running the nation of England. Puritans were in charge of the universities, Oxford and Cambridge. John Owen was the Vice Chancellor of Oxford. Can you imagine? And then suddenly, in 1662, it was all gone. In 1662, those Puritan pastors were expelled from the Church of England. Over 2,000 evangelical ministers removed from their pulpits. Laws were passed that Puritans could not attend the universities of Oxford and Cambridge. Only members in good standing of the Church of England. And so anybody sympathetic with the Puritan party, anybody who was nonconformist, was excluded from the gateway into cultural influence, which was the great universities. And needless to say, in the reign of Charles II, Puritans were gone from influence in the government. From 20 years of cultural ascendancy, suddenly the Puritans are in exile. It's horrible, terrible, disaster. What did God do in that situation? Well, many of those expelled Puritans came to the English colonies in America. New England, Chesapeake Bay, the Carolinas. And became the core of what would become the American experiment. In Britain, among the nonconformists, and even in the Church of England, 60, 70, 80 years later, evangelical revival began amongst them. And modern evangelicalism came out of that expelled English nonconformity. So, Bible-believing, big God theology embracing, doctrines of grace preaching Puritans in independent, Baptist, Presbyterian, and other groups of Christians articulated a theology which we began to eventually call the theology of evangelicalism. That's where evangelicalism came from. So out of what would have looked to them like an unmitigated disaster, God was up to something big. When you look at your culture today and you're discouraged, let me give you this practical encouragement. Don't think God is not up to something. He's preparing for something big. You and I don't know what it is, but we don't need to know what it is. We just need to know that He's in charge, and our job is to be faithful. Now, that leads me to my second thing. Here's my second piece of practical encouragement to you as you engage with this culture. Think of bad times as the opportunity to be and do what God has made you to be and do. Think of bad times as the opportunity to be and do what God has made you to do. Instead of throwing your hands up and saying, I give up, instead of retreating, you know, trying to find some safe area to huddle in, think like Mordecai said to Esther, maybe I was born for such a time as this. And don't think that you have to do the one heroic thing that will save the day. I don't know whether he's going to talk about it, but Harry and I were talking about this today. We don't necessarily need people to do the one heroic thing. We need them to do thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of small, faithful things. So marriage is in a mess in our culture. What are you going to do about it? I've got a suggestion. Stay married to your wife. I'm not kidding. Who would have thought that there would be a day when you could have a colossally powerful Christian witness by having an intact family? And guess what? God has given us a culture where you can do just that. You can have a huge impact by being married, by showing that you love your wife and that you want to care for your children, or that you love your husband and you want to care for your children. Huge impacts can be had by simple faithfulness from Christians. Don't think that you have to do the one big heroic thing. It will be in simple faithfulness that you will bear witness in this culture. But approach it not, oh no, this is bad, I want to retreat and go find someplace safe. No, say, no, this is the moment that God made me for. This is my opportunity to stand up and bear witness. This is my opportunity to say, in answer to the question, who is on the Lord's side? Here I am. Think of bad times as the opportunity to be what God has made you to be. Now that leads me to my third point. Believe in the providence of God. I think in our day and age, there is nothing more important than to believe that God is watching over you, that He is caring for you, that He is intimately involved in every part of your life than the days in which we live. We live in a day and age which is toxic to faith. The world is not helping you believe. And I believe we are one step away from walking away from Christianity when we cease to believe in the providence of God over us. Believe in the providence of God. That God is watching over you, caring for you. Jesus has to speak to His disciples about this in the Sermon on the Mount. Not a hair can fall from your head, He says to them, apart from the will of your Father in heaven. Why do we need to hear that so much? Because when the world turns its back on you, or when the world turns antagonistic to you, and you feel unheard, that's a very frightening, scary place to be. And what do many people do? They react by doing anything they can do to get acceptance. What does a Christian need to do in that context? Recognize that friendship with the world is enmity with God. But that to walk with God is to have His watch care over you. So we don't look to the world to give us what only God can give us. So there's never been a time when it's been more important to believe in the providence of God. If you want to engage with this culture, if you want to speak into this culture, what you want is you want the affirmation of God, not the affirmation of this culture. And if you don't believe in the providence of God, you won't be able to sense the affirmation of God in the midst of this culture. So it is vital for us to believe that His eye is on the sparrow, and I know He cares for me. That is absolutely essential in this cultural moment. And along with that, we must believe that He will build His church. The church is not in the balance. The church will never perish, her dear Lord to defend. Some of the great mistakes that have been made in accommodating this world have been made by people who made the vital miscalculation that it is possible for God's church to fail or cease. Jesus Himself said He would build His church and the gates of hell would not prevail against it. Believe Him. As we say, He's got this. Believe that. It's very important for you to believe that. What does that allow you to do? It allows you, no matter how outmanned you feel, to march into the warfare of this world with confidence that the gates of hell will not prevail. So believing in the providence of God is actually a key encouragement for engaging in our world and culture today. Now, let me say this, it's sort of a subpoint under number three. Believing in the providence of God does not mean abandoning a sense of personal responsibility. You know, it's not, well, God's in charge, so it doesn't matter what I do. It's very interesting. That deduction is never drawn in the Bible. The logic of the Bible is always, because God is sovereign, therefore I am responsible. It's not because God is sovereign, therefore I'm not responsible. That's Islamic theology. God is sovereign, so I'm not responsible. Christian theology is, God is sovereign, so I'm responsible. In other words, because God is sovereign, what I do matters. It counts. And that's emphasized in both the Old and the New Testament. What's the Bible book that doesn't mention God? Esther. But God's all over it, right? What especially about God is all over the book of Esther? His providence. What verse epitomizes that in the book of Esther? Esther 4:14. Turn with me there. Esther 4:14. Mordecai assures Esther this. If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. So Mordecai says, let me just absolutely assure you this. God is going to preserve his people. Relief and deliverance is going to rise for another place. And of course, what he says then is, therefore, Esther, it doesn't matter what you do. No, that's not what he says. He says, relief and deliverance will arise from another place, but maybe you were made for such a time as this. Maybe the reason you're in the king's court is such a time as this. In other words, because I've got complete confidence that God has got this, he is going to deliver his people. Maybe, just maybe, he's going to use my little faithfulness to accomplish his will. In fact, we're assured of this. Nothing that you do for him will not count. Hear that again. Nothing that you do for him will not count. No action, no faithful action of a believer is ever meaningless. Do you understand what that means, friends? It means that whatever you do in all of life in faithfulness is full of meaning, eternal significance. Relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews. But maybe you were made for such a time as this. Maybe this is why God has put you in the court. That's the attitude that we have to have. God is sovereign. That means not that it doesn't matter whether I'm faithful when I'm engaging this culture. It means that everything that I do matters. He will use it. Now, turn to the New Testament, to the counterpart of this. Look at the very end of the book of Acts. It's one of my favorite passages in all of the New Testament, Acts chapter 27. In Acts chapter 27, you remember the story. Paul warns the centurion who is in charge of this cohort of prisoners not to set sail. Acts chapter 27, verse 10. Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with injury and much loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. So Paul warns him, this is a dangerous voyage you're undertaking. You're in danger of losing the ship, the cargo, and us. The centurion ignores him. Immediately, they find themselves in a great storm, in danger of the loss of the ship, the cargo, and the passengers. So look down a few verses. Paul addresses them again. Men, you should have listened to me. You knew the preacher was going to say that. Verse 21, men, you should have listened to me and not set sail from Crete and incurred this injury and loss. Yet now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. Hold on. How do you know that? This ship will be lost, but none of your lives will be lost. How do you know that? Paul tells them. This very night there stood before me an angel of God to whom I belong and whom I worship. And he said, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all who sail with you. You understand what Paul's saying? Paul had gone down in the hold of that ship and he said, Lord God, give me every single one of these lives. And the angel came to Paul and said, Paul, your prayer has been heard. All of these lives will be spared. So he stands up and he says, you should have listened to me. You're going to lose the ship. You're going to lose the cargo, but you're all going to live. Then, look what happens. This keeps on going for 14 days. And Paul sees the sailors trying to escape from the ship 2 weeks later, and he says this. Look at verse 31. Unless these men stay on the ship, you cannot be saved. And you want to go, whoa, 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 wait a second, Paul. You said none of us were going to die. Now you're telling us if we don't keep those sailors on the ship, we're all going to die. Which is it? And his answer is yes. Now, do you get that? God is sovereign over this thing. He's told Paul that he's going to save those lives. But Paul says, you keep those sailors on the ship or we're all going to die. Now, which is it? Is God sovereign or is the responsibility to keep those sailors on the ship absolutely necessary for the saving of their lives? Again, the answer is yes. You see, God's providence does not mean that our responsibility does not matter. God often appoints our faithfulness as the means by which He accomplishes His will. We've got to believe in God's sovereignty. We've got to believe in His providence. But that does not alleviate our responsibility in this cultural moment. We're called to be faithful. Just like they had, remember what they did? They cut the ropes on those lifeboats and let them fall into the sea and crash and said, well, sailors, you are with us now. And guess what? In the next chapter, when they were all counted up, every last man was there. God's sovereign, they were responsible. That's how it always works. So providence comforts us, but it also motivates us to activity in this culture. Here's a fourth thing that I want you to see. Take the posture in this culture that you will bless those who curse you. Take the posture in this culture that you will bless those who curse you. You remember, God promised Abraham that He would bless those who blessed him and He would curse those who cursed him. And the promises of Abraham, Luke and Paul and Peter say belong to you, believer. So guess what? You don't need to worry about cursing people. God will handle that. And it allows you to live to bless them. Your attitude needs to be to this culture, you can't hate me enough to stop me loving you. Come on, keep hating me more, because I'm going to keep on blessing you. And Jesus even says, do that and just heap coals on their head. You have got to be in the mode of, I don't care how much this world is against me, I am here to bless you. God will handle everything else for me. I'm here to bless you. Fifth, you need to know your culture. You need to know your culture. As Christians, we need to know our Bible. We need to know the gospel. We need to know the church and how important it is. But we also need to know the culture. For instance, I don't think that you can understand this culture apart from something that sociologists have been saying about modernity for a long time. There is a whole school of sociological interpretation of where we are today that says that much of what we see going on around us is simply rationalized sexual promiscuity. That is very, very intelligent people working very, very hard to justify their own promiscuity. In fact, I don't think you can understand the cultural moment that we are in today apart from the explosion of pornography. I think pornography has robbed the moral heart and backbone of the males of the leadership culture that we live in today. I think when you are gripped and preoccupied with watching perversity hours on end, it makes it very hard for you to take any moral stand publicly because you know you're a hypocrite. And I think that that absolutely paralyzes the leadership culture of the Western world today. So we need to take some time and know our culture a little bit. Understand what's ticking beneath it. And there have been wonderful studies of this. For instance, one thing that all of us in a political season like ours, we need to go back and read a book that was written about 30 years ago by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. That book explains that the American presidential election of 2016 is explained in that book from 30 years ago. And what one of the things that that book does is it shows how the medias that we prefer in this culture, especially visual media, especially television and video media, have robbed us of the capacity to think. And that is on bold display as the American presidential election, the crown of democracy in the history of humankind, has devolved into a reality TV show. So you need to go and read that. But all of this is, you want to know your culture and understand your culture so that you can speak faithfully to your culture. One last thing. In Matthew, turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus says this to his disciples. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the stand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. One of the things that Jesus is saying here is if you're going to be any good to this world, you must be different from this world. If you are not distinct, you have nothing to offer it. But if you are withdrawn from this world and hidden from this world, you do this world no good. So you must be different, but you must be engaged. You can't be like the world or you're no good to the world. You can't be separated from the world or you're no good to the world. You must be different from the world and engaged in the world. In other words, you need to love the world without loving the world. You need to know that I am here to be a witness to Jesus, to the Father, to do good works so that the world gives glory to Him. I want to love the world. I don't want to be in love with the world. Jesus will say later, what? Do not love the world. But I want to love the world in the sense of I understand that I'm here to bear witness to the Father. And I don't want to withdraw from the world or I can't bear that witness to the Father. So I want to love the world without loving the world. And I want to be different from the world without hating the world. Those are some encouragements as you think about how to engage this culture. We'll continue these thoughts tomorrow evening. God bless you all.